Okay, hi everybody. It's 1 o'clock. It's Monday. It must be time to learn Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa. And welcome back. I am pleased to say that I've overcome my technical difficulties. I hope that the screen is not upside down or sideways as it was last week. And we meet this time in a something of a different world. Those of us in Israel are in a world which is a little bit more open. It's a world in which we can go to, those of us who have, even people who don't have, but those of us who have a green passport can go to, can go out, we can go for a coffee, we can go to the gym, we can gather and meet and have happy occasions that are a little bit, open with more people. I went to the first wedding, my first wedding last night. I don't remember the last time I went to a wedding, even virtually actually. And it was the first time that I really had to worry about getting dressed from the waist down since all of this craziness started, because everything's been on Zoom. So I hope you're all. I hope those of us who are Israelis, I hope you're all. You're all out there and you're enjoying and following the rules, because the only way we're going to get through this is by continuing to follow the rules. And if you haven't gotten vaccinated, please get vaccinated, and please get your Darkon Yahok, get your green passport, and let's try to see this through, and maybe we'll have a Pesach which is a lot more normal than the one we had last year. So that being the case, let's get going. We last week started or continued our discussion of the Mishnah in the first chapter of Pirkei Avot, chapter 1, Mishnah 16. The Mishnah is cited in the name of Rabban Gamliel, who was the grandson of Hillel the Elder, who we spent a lot of time discussing. He was the head of the Pharisees. According to Chazal, he was the head of the Sanhedrin in the first century BCE, in the first part of the first century BCE. I'm sorry, CE. What's the matter with me? CE. For those of you interested in historical, not oddities, but sort of like the historical trivia, according to Paul of Tarsus, or Saul of Tarsus, he was his teacher. He was sent by his father, Paul from Tarsus, which is a city on the eastern Mediterranean littoral, to study Torah in the house of, in the academy of Rabban Gamliel. Paul did not turn out to be everything that the father wanted, I assume, but that's another story. In any event, Rabban Gamliel gives us three admonitions, which maybe go together, maybe don't. We're going to talk about that when we get to the end. This is going to be a long discussion, even though it's very short. The words that he says are very terse, but still. Aseh lecha rav, pick yourself a teacher. Vistalek ma'asafek. And avoid or evade doubt. Ve'al tarbel la'aser u'madot. And when you do your tithing, don't do it by estimation. You should do it by precision. The first two certainly go together. The third, we'll have to see what that really means. But in the meantime, the past 2 weeks, we've discussed the question of what does it mean? How do you pick a teacher? Why do you need a teacher? What's the purpose of a teacher? And why is the Torah so emphatic about it? Today we're going to segue into the second part of Rabban Gamliel's statement, which is Histalek Ma'asafek. Choose a teacher and avoid or evade. They're not the same. And evade doubt. Now, the truth of the matter is that one could see the first one leading to the second one. That's sort of normal. Aseh lecha rav, if you have a teacher, you'll be able to avoid doubt. Questions: why does that work? How is that? So there are different ways of looking at this transition, of this segue from part one to part two. One could say that if one has a teacher, then one doesn't have to have any doubts because you can ask him and you can rely on him. Now, when it comes to specialized things, that's true. If you have a halachic question, you go to a rabbi who has the training and has the knowledge and the insight and sensitivity and the ability to be able to discern the specifics of your case. He'll decide, and you won't have a doubt. You can say, I rely on him. So that's one possibility. From the late 19th century onward, you have the concept which is developed in Orthodoxy, which is called Da Torah, that rabbis, unique rabbis, not every rabbi, that outstanding rabbis, especially Hasidic rabbis, I say Hasidic Rebbeim, Admorim, who have not only brains, not only insight and intelligence, but also some sort of divine inspiration according to Hasidut, whatever they say, even on matters of non-halachic import, on matters of just public policy, or how to run your life, or what should you buy a house, should you, whatever the case might be, that you can rely on them. If Mesel Harav or Mesel Harebe, Bistaleg Masafek, you can rely on them because anything they say is literally the word of God speaking from their mouth. Now, this concept of Da'at Torah, which I don't have time to go into right now, is somewhat, it's certainly controversial. I personally, and my teacher, Rabbi Soloveitchik, was not a big fan of it. On the grounds, on two grounds. Ground number one, that while it is certainly true that if a person has a personal dilemma and a personal quandary, or wants advice, the obvious place to go is a person of piety, a person of integrity, a person of honesty. And if one's dilemma or one's personal question actually has religious implications, you should go to a person who used to go to a rabbi and consult with them. That would seem to be the obvious thing to do. That's not quite the same as saying whatever the rabbi says, or with a great rabbi, is a divine revelation which is binding me. So this idea of Da'at Torah is very common today. It's a relatively new thing. But that would be the simple meaning of the verse of the Mishnah rather. Aselech harav, get yourself a Rebbe, v'stalag masafek, you always ask them anything based on the doctrine of Da'at Torah. There is a significant group of prominent Torah teachers who are not happy with this idea of Da'at Torah. On the contrary, as I said, Rav Soloveitchik certainly was more than willing to advise people and to spend time with them and to help them work out issues and so on and so forth. And his wisdom was certainly something those people who had access to it were more than willing to take advantage of. I mean, in the sense of asking. But by the same token, the Rav Amital from Gush Etzion is known for this position as well, and I think Rav Lichtenstein as well. Their position is somewhat different, and it brings us back to a comment at the beginning of Pirkei Avot. You'll recall the three statements that are attributed to the men of the Great Assembly in the fifth, fourth, then third, in the beginning of the second century BCE, that Ha'amidu Talmidim Harbeh, one should raise up a lot of students, and Rav Soloveitchik used to say, Ha'amidu Talmidim Harbeh means train your students in such a way that they can responsibly stand on their own two feet. In other words, that they won't just go and do whatever they want, but what they do, whatever decisions they make and whatever rulings they make or interpretations they make will be based on judicious understanding and respectful and reverential understanding of the traditions that they receive. But still, they can stand on their own two feet and make up their own mind. That's a very normative rabbinic position. And this idea that you should take responsibility for yourself is something that Rav Soloveitchik used to very much emphasize. I remember on more than one occasion, and I'm not the only one, when I would ask him the Rav a question, the answer he would give would be, do what you think is right. Now, he was willing to discuss anything you wanted, but ultimately the buck stops with you. So the idea of Da'at Torah is really not coterminous with or identical with this, which is the second approach, which would mean that we interpret the Mishnah to mean Aselech HaRav, and by the virtue of the training that you have, is to lake mass effect. Now, that's a different development because unless a person is going to train, your relationship to your authority figure is going to be different, by the way. I'd be less than honest if I didn't admit that those of us who, if you go and ask a great Rav, even if you don't think that he's demanding that you obey him, Nevertheless, you have to you're going to attribute a tremendous amount of gravitas and significance to what he tells you, because he's part of you and knows more than you, has more experience than you, more life experience than you. So that it's not that open and shut. But nevertheless, there's certainly much more in the second interpretation, that of, be responsible for your own decisions, that there's more room for freedom of movement and for independence on the contrary, when we, I remember more than one occasion when we would ask the Rav a question, and he would say, "I want to hear what you have to say. Don't tell me what I have to say. I know what I have to say," he would say. "But I want to hear what you have to say in terms of, even if it's something, interpretive and commenting in Gemara, commenting on the Bible, whatever the case might be." He was very anxious for everybody to develop themselves, and that's another form of hisdalek masafek, to abandon doubt. Now, what I want to do now is detach this second section of the Mishnah, the hisdalek masafek, from its previous piece, and just zero in on it per se. Hisdalek masafek. So the question is, what does that mean? What does that imply? So I have to define certain things. Okay. First of all, what does it mean, listalek? What does it mean to evade or avoid or to keep away from, run away from? Listalek can mean to run away, it can mean to evade. There's very, there are very nuances to language. Language is a very supple thing. Hebrew especially is an incredibly supple language. And as a result, we have to see what the word means. Number one. Number two, what's a safek? What's a doubt? What does it mean, and what does it presume? I've told you more than once that, especially in Pirkei Avot and the Haggadah, by the way, you have words that seemingly are self-evidently obvious in what they mean, but by the same token, when you look deeper, they actually are deceptively simple. There's a lot more to them. What is doubt? What does doubt presume? Okay, so let me concentrate on the word doubt first, and we'll get back to the question of evading it or avoiding it, because obviously how we define doubt is going to define listalek, because if doubt is a good thing, if doubt is a bad thing, if doubt is a neutral thing, that will determine how intensely I have to avoid it, and how intensely I have to rely on somebody else, and how much I have to work to make sure I don't have any part of it. Or maybe I do, maybe it's something which is not terrible, maybe doubt is something which is a legitimate religious category, which is what I've called this series of shiurim, which is probably going to last us right up into Pesach. How you respond to something will depend on what that thing is. Oh. So what is doubt? So doubt, and of course, if you go into the philosophical dictionaries, they'll make you crazy, and they'll tell you all kinds of different definitions. Doubt means, on its baseline, lack of certainty. Okay. It's a word which has philosophic, religious, and scientific relevance. Okay. Doubt means I'm not sure. I don't know if I know what I pretend to know. I don't know if that which I have asserted or that which I have accepted is really true. Now, that's very nice, okay? We all have doubts about all kinds of things. But then the question becomes, okay, if I have doubt, does that mean there's something wrong with me? Or there's something missing in me? Or is it possible that I can never really know? Am I able to really know anything? Or everything is very unstable. Can I really know? And is there an absolute truth to know? That's something else as well. You could say that there's truth, but I'm not sure if I can know, if I'm 100% sure of what I know of what that truth is. Or I can say, which is the which is a very common position today, there's nothing true. It's interesting, the same people that claim that in interhuman relations that nothing is true, that there's no morals, there's no anything, there's no values, it all depends on what I want, what I think, and I make my own truth, they'll scream and yell about you have to be dogmatic about science, which is kind of funny because science is based on skepticism. What skepticism means, I don't think I can know. The skeptics in Greece, for example, were of the opinion that you can't know anything, that there is what to know, there are truths, but we can never know what they are. So you see, it's very interesting. Vistalik masa fake. What kind of doubt are we talking about? Now, if doubt is something that in the context of Pirkei Avot, okay, clearly, if you have to avoid doubt, then that assumes, and I think that's fairly obvious for a religious context, that there is what to know, there is truth, because there's God, and God is absolute truth. And anything God gives is absolutely true. But still, okay, even if that's the case, and anybody who's had experienced the presence of God can testify to the fact that they know that that's absolute truth. In fact, even people that have out-of-body experiences say the same thing, that they have this amazing sense of calm because they encounter absolute, unadulterated, and pure truth, which is binding. Anyways, but let's leave that aside. So the histaleg masafek, if that's the case, is that you don't know that you can know absolute truth, but doesn't mean it's not there. The possibility that there is no truth is not an option within a religious context. The Torah does not abide such a position under any circumstances, even within the broad spectrum of Jewish philosophy. What you do have is the following. There is a Jews came to philosophy, or philosophy hit monotheistic religions in the early Middle Ages. First, the Muslims encountered philosophy, then the Jews, and then the Christians. Christians were last in order. And philosophy, Greek philosophy, certainly Aristotelian philosophy, assumed that one can, you know, if you do the work properly and you're smart enough and you're consistent enough, you don't make mistakes, arrive at truth. That was Aristotle's assumption. And Maimonides, for example, said that as a result, then you should work on your philosophical studies and you should develop your religious persona and your belief to the point that you can actually know or come to know as much as possible. We'll talk about this more next week, but the Rambam in the beginning of the Mishneh Torah says Yisod Yisodot Vamura Chochmot Leidashi Yesham Matzui Rishon Vomamtzi Kol Nimtza, that the foundation of religion is to know that there's a God. That means that you should have it established in your head 100% that you're absolutely sure and that you have no doubt about the fact that there's a God, and you can prove it philosophically and logically. In the 11th century, there was a famous Muslim philosopher whose name was Muhammad al-Ghazali. And Ghazali wrote a famous tract called Tahafut al-Falsifa, The Destruction of Philosophy. And in the destruction of philosophy, Ghazali basically argued that man is too limited, that there clearly is a God, and there certainly is a God, but belief is superior to knowledge, because we will always be guilty of doubt, and we will have questions and whatever, and we will know, and people are not stable, and therefore for us to be arrogant enough to think that we can know is a little stupid. It testifies to our own arrogance. They argued, and again we'll talk about this more next week, that you can know things beyond what you can know things on a belief level, on an intuitive level, on an experiential level, that you absolutely cannot prove rationally, and that level of knowing is actually higher. Doesn't mean you know it less. A person knows that they love someone, that they're unshakable in their love. Nevertheless, you can't prove love. You can't prove love to the person who's the object of your love, by definition. Because you can't have, nobody else can feel what you feel. You can try to elicit, you can try to express, you can do all kinds of things. But you can't prove it, certainly not rationally, with rational argument. said Ghazali, and who picked up the and the Jewish thought thinker who picked up this line of thought was Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari, said that there are levels of knowledge and levels of knowledge of God which transcend or go beyond anything that that reason can establish. And we are not going to enslave our relationship with God and certainly relationship to Torah in rational arguments which are easily undone, to which you can easily cast a monkey wrench. So if that's the case, histalek ma'asafek would mean, in this regard, two different things for, say, the Rambam and for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Histalek ma'asafek, asel l'charav histalek ma'asafek, according to Rihal, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, would mean to learn and to develop your belief and avoid doubt because there are not some things you just can't prove and you just know. The Rambam would say that doubt is bad because you didn't do your homework well enough. Asel l'charav and study philosophy properly so that you can establish your religion totally on reason. Okay? Those are two different things. Those are obviously two different things. Doubt, according to Rihal, means tells us the limitations of ourselves, and whereas according to Maimonides, least like masafek means that you've done your homework. It's a moral judgment or educational judgment against you. So those are not the same thing. But that was not the part of this that I actually wanted to discuss today, and I see that we're getting to the end of the half hour, so I'll start and we'll continue this part next week. What I want to discuss really today is a question of the implications of doubt and of knowledge when it comes to halacha, and the question of machloket. There's a famous story. Jews like to fight. Jews like to argue. The Talmud is full of discussion. There is, however, this idea that Judaism is a system of asking questions, and there's no responsibility, there's no aim towards truth. That's a total misnomer. That just shows rank ignorance. But it is true that Judaism, that the Talmud is one long, unending discussion. And we talked about this last week a little bit. We talked about this idea that when you learn Torah, that you're actually living in a transgenerational, transhistorical experience where you encounter people who lived at different times and different ages. When it comes to halakha, we try to come up with an answer because you have to know what to do. But the question is, and that's the issue that raises the question of machloket, which I mentioned. Jews like to fight, Jews like to argue, Jews like to. We answer. Lou Weiss says we always answer a question with a question. Also true. But I'd like to call your attention to the fact that there is a very interesting difference of opinion among the two major halachic traditions, the Sephardic Babylonian and the Eretz Israeli Ashkenazi, as to the nature of machloket, the nature of truth, and the question of can we ever reach some kind of finality when it comes to poskening a shiloh, when it comes to deciding what God wants us to do when it comes to halacha. Let's start with Babylonia. One of the things that characterizes, or Mizrahi, I should say, Babylonian Mizrahi, the rabbis who lived largely in Arab countries, is the idea that that the Torah is based on end logic. What I mean end logic, meaning that something cannot be both A and not A. It can't be both right and can be wrong. In other words, that there is, by definition, if it's true, if A is true, then minus A, then the opposite can't be true. Well, if that's the case, what does it mean when the Gemara says in Erevin, Daf Yigimel and Bet, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, that these and these are the words of the living God? What does that mean? How can that be? And in fact, in the 14th century, Rabbi Yontif ben Avram ben of Seville, the Ritva, says it can't be both ways. And in fact, he didn't ask the question the first time. Chazal already asked, and there's a medrash in, and he quotes this medrash, there's a medrash in Medrash Tilim, which says that God, Moses went up to heaven, and he found that everybody was fighting and arguing in the yeshiva Shomali. He says, I can't work with this. What do you want from my life? If everybody's fighting up here, what do you want us down there? So the response that the starting with Rav Sajagon at least, starting in other words with the 10th century at least in Baghdad, the answer that was generally given by Sephardic or as I say Mizrahi authorities was that there really is only one answer. However, there's no more revelation. We can't pick up the phone and ask God and ask, well, so how are we passing over here? What we have is the Torah. We have the canonized tools of interpreting the Torah, which are based on assumptions about the nature of the text and the supplementary information and traditions that that were passed on through the generations. And we do the best we can. And sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. But what we do try to achieve is to try to reach the truth. The line, what we come up with as much as humanly possible with what you know, what Klapei Shemaya Galia, what as far as from a heaven point of view, is true. Therefore, machloket, therefore argument, controversy is bad. Which they doubt is bad. Why is controversy bad? Because it means one side is right and one side is wrong. It means that we haven't done our homework. If there really is only one way, then there shouldn't be differences of opinions. And the fact that there is that's not the situation is a circumstance which must be much bemoaned, much regretted, and also ameliorated to the degree possible. The person who the way this is explained, I mean, almost, heck, I won't say cruelly, but certainly forcefully. Rav Sajagon, in the beginning of his philosophical book, the Emunot Va'adeot, says, he quotes a Gemara in Sanhedrin, where the Gemara says, Misharabu talmidi beis shamay beis hillel, v'lashilo shimshu et raboteim kol sorcham, nitrabu te machlokot b'Yisrael. That from the time of when the students of Shammai and Hillel didn't do their homework, they didn't study hard enough with Hillel and Shammai, and since they didn't get their homework and they were guilty of intellectual and religious lassitude, then all of a sudden there were a tremendous amount of machlokot, of differences of opinion. But there was no way to determine anymore because there's no more revelation. So what do? So you vote, you do all kinds of rules to know what to do. But it's a bad situation. And the thing to try to achieve is to try to transcend the machlokot, to work very hard, to make smaller, to decrease the number of arguments, so that we can try to achieve unity to the degree possible. That is the reason why. Sorry. Okay, let's go back to where we were. I said I was knocked off offline. Because machloket is a bad thing, and we really should try to achieve unity, which will approximate, we hope, the ultimate one truth. As a result, we should strive to try to decrease the number of arguments. We should try to decrease the number of differences of opinion. And as a result, we should strive to reach, as I said, unity as much as possible. So, according to this line of thinking, the most important thing to do is to take all of the machlokot, all of the differences of opinion, and do what? We should go and we should try to decide them or try to figure out which one is right, which is wrong. And that's the reason why Sephardim, more than anybody else, Mizrahi Jews, rabbis more than anybody else, wrote books, codes of Jewish law. It's very simple. Who wrote the major codes of Jewish law? Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, who came from Fez and then came to Lucena in Spain. Maimonides. For our purposes, Rabbi Asher ben Yechiel, who was a, or Yaakov ben Asher, rather, who was in Toledo, who was an Ashkenazi, but Most of his career was in Spain, the Turim, and of course the Shulchan Aruch. And in fact, more than anybody else, who wanted unity and uniformity in halachic observance, first among Sephardim and then among everybody else? Rav Avadia Yosef. It was he more than anybody else in our generation who strove that. He embodies this idea that machloket is bad. Doubt is bad, because there's a truth and we have to strive towards that truth. So that's on the Sephardic side. I see that our time is up. We will continue this Emir Tashem next week and look at the Ashkenazim, and then we'll go into the questions of belief. In the meantime, again, if you haven't been vaccinated, go. Get your vaccinations. Be well. We'll see you next week.